It's that time of year when the release of the state papers give us a special insight into what went on behind closed doors in government 30 years ago. David McCullough has been going through some of the mound of 10,000 documents for us, starting with a state visit of Russia's President Yeltsin in 1994, which didn't quite happen as planned.
In September of 1994, Boris Yeltsin was on his way back from a trip to America. His plane landed in Shannon for refuelling, and there was a big hoo-ha about the Taoiseach arriving and senior ministers arriving to greet him as he came off the plane. But come off the plane, he did not.
Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Soskovitz emerged to say President Yeltsin was indisposed and would be unable to meet the Taoiseach for the planned talks.
See, we have been flying for about 17 hours.
And I think
it is
understandable
that physical, potential or human being are not limitless.
Is he unwell? Is the president unwell?
He's just tired.
I was here in RTE that day. I was monitoring a live video feed of the plane on the tarmac, eyes trained on the door to see if it would ever open and whether this character, who really was a larger-than-life world figure at the time, would ever set foot in Ireland. What do the papers tell us about what actually happened?
Well, they're very interesting because, I mean, as you heard there, the claim the Russians made was that the president was tired and he couldn't come down the steps to meet Albert Reynolds because of his fatigue, and later on there were suggestions that his bodyguards had been too afraid to wake him and all that sort of stuff. All nonsense, of course. Everybody knew what the problem was. Boris Yeltsin, unfortunately for him, had an alcohol problem just the month before. There was a big ceremony in Berlin for the withdrawal of Russian troops, and people of our vintage, Carol, will remember him grabbing the conductor's baton and trying to conduct a military band and then grabbing the microphone and singing a song and everything. And he was clearly the worst for alcohol. So the papers tell us various things. There's a very interesting memo by a man called Liam Kniff, who was the acting head of protocol in the Department of Foreign Affairs at the time. And the lads are all standing there on the red carpet, and they get a message shortly before the plane was due to land that it would be delayed for an hour. Now, the plane was circling around Shannon. It could be seen and heard. And obviously, the thinking Department of Foreign Affairs Assistant Secretary Noel Fahey said, President Yeltsin's indisposition was at one stage seen as curable. In other words, he'd sober up. But that in the end, it was decided not to take a risk of events such as took place in Berlin. So they didn't want him coming down the steps and making a show of himself. The head of protocol went up the steps. He went into the plane to formally welcome President Yeltsin. And as soon as he got in, two guys in shirt sleeves, who are obviously the security detail, slammed shut the door into the passenger cabin so he couldn't see what was going on. Oh, so Mr. Kniff suggested that the Taoiseach would come onto the plane and meet the president. And there was a hurried confab between the Russian officials, and they said, well, no, maybe that wouldn't be a good idea. So eventually they sent down the deputy first prime minister to have a chat with Albert Reynolds. But what's interesting is the Irish side knew what the problem was. They knew that Yeltsin was obviously the worst for alcohol, but they played along with the Russian story because they, at the time, were looking for tax breaks for the Aryan to run duty-free shops in Moscow. So it was in our interest to pretend that everything was okay. So Albert Reynolds was given an invitation to come and visit Yeltsin in Moscow early the following year. And obviously there was a hope that there would be some goodies in it for Ireland.
Now, we also learned that in this period there was some consternation in government circles about the purchase of arms from Israel. What was that all about?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. In 1992, the Minister for Foreign Affairs at the time was David Andrews, and he was really unhappy about the fact that we were buying ammunition principally, but also other things, rifle grenades, mortars, rifles and helmets from Israel. About 7% of total ammunition and weapons purchases were coming from there. And Andrews made the point that Irish peacekeepers with UNIFIL were being subjected to harassment by forces backed by Israel. There was Irish soldiers had been killed by forces backed by Israel, and he took a very dim view of this. He said it was an error of judgment to continue buying guns and ammunition. And in a very sarcastic comment, he said the bullets used by the Israelis to kill Irish troops presumably come from different manufacturers than those intended to be supplied to our army. So he was making a very serious point, and the department was very worried. about military equipment being purchased from a country which it said was responsible, indirectly, presumably, for the deaths of Irish soldiers. And they really were arguing strongly that this was a very, very bad look. But the Minister for Defence at the time, John Wilson, also the Taoiseach, was making the point that the Israeli tender for supplying the ammunition was quite a bit cheaper than the next lowest. It was £570,000 as they were at the time, compared to the next lowest bid, which was £647,000. So John Wilson said, no, we have to go with the cheapest tender. And the Minister for Finance at the time, who was Bertie Ahern, backed him. So David Andrews had to very reluctantly accede to that.
The state papers always give us a decent insight into some of the very significant events in Northern Ireland. What do this year's tranche tell us about what was going on there?
There's a really interesting insight into the inquiry into Bloody Sunday, which was announced in 1998 by Tony Blair. We can have a listen to how he announced it in the House of Commons.
Lord Savile of Newdigate has agreed to chair a tribunal of three. It is not possible to say now exactly how long the inquiry will take, but it should be allowed the time necessary to cover all the evidence now available thoroughly and completely. It is for the tribunal to decide how far its proceedings will be open, but the Act requires them to be held in public unless there are special countervailing considerations.
Now, that announcement was made, as I said, in 1998, 26 years after Bloody Sunday, when 13 civil rights marchers were shot dead on the day. Another died some months later. And there was an inquiry in 1972 carried out by the Lord Chief Justice of England, Lord Widgery, which was basically seen as a whitewash. It exonerated the soldiers involved. So there was a lengthy campaign, a quarter of a century, by the relatives of the victims, backed by the Irish government, to have a new inquiry. Now, this went down very badly with the British Army. And in particular, it went down very badly with the commander of British troops in Northern Ireland, General Sir Rupert Smith. Smith had been invited to dinner by Irish diplomats based in Belfast, and they mentioned the subject of the just announced inquiry, and Smith basically threw the head completely. He started giving out yards about the British government. He expressed his trenchant opposition to what he called a cynical political move designed to scapegoat soldiers yet again. Smith was himself a former member of the officer in the parachute regiment. He had served in Northern Ireland. He wasn't in Bloody Sunday on the day. But he had, in the course of his service in Northern Ireland, been blown up by an IRA bomb and suffered extensive burns. And he said, where's the inquiry into what happened to me? Right. So it's quite extraordinary to see a senior serving British officer giving out about his own government to officials of another government.
That would have been extraordinary.
It was absolutely extraordinary, and it's clear that the Irish officials were a bit taken aback by it.
We also learned something new about what was happening in the world of loyalist paramilitary groups in Northern Ireland in the 90s.
Yeah, so if you cast your mind back to the early 1990s, the loyalist paramilitaries, the UDA, the UVF, they were becoming much more efficient. And they were getting much better at covering their tracks, destroying forensic evidence by burning out getaway cars, for instance. And they were under instructions to take showers after operations. Now, this led to the downfall of one particular loyalist terrorist because he'd been involved in a shooting operation. He was under orders to go and take a shower, which he did. But he was also out on bail on another charge, and he had to sign on to the local RUC station. And as soon as he walked in, the RUC noticed that he was still dripping wet from his shower. And their suspicions were raised because the person in question was not known for his regular bathing habits. So they arrested him and
only in the state papers, David.
Exactly. They were also developing a kind of an ideological background. But one loyalist contact said to an Irish official, this is, I found really chilling, in the final analysis, recruits joined the UVF to shoot people. So don't overestimate their political sophistication. But having said that, after the IRA ceasefire in 1994, came the thankful announcement from UVF figure Gusty Spence that the war was over.
The combined Loyalist Military Command will universally cease all operational hostilities as from 12 midnight on Thursday, the 13th of October 1994. In all sincerity, we offer to the loved ones of all innocent victims over the past 25 years abject and true remorse.
The voice of the late Gusty Spence in 1994, ending our look at the state papers with Dave McCullough. And details on how to look at them yourself online or in person are on the RTE website.